Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larkin, Judge Werke, Judge Flory, the Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Good morning, please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's 27th day of February 2020. We're ready for oral arguments in the three cases that are scheduled before us this morning. The first is Grand Central Lofts Phase 1 Condominiums versus Grand Central Lofts Master Association, Grand Central Cottages Homeowners Association. So we understand it, there'll be a splitting of time for the three appellants, 7, 2, and 6. The clock has been set accordingly. Would each attorney who argues before us this morning be sure to state his or her name for the record immediately before beginning oral argument so we have a record of who's said what. With that, we are ready for arguments on behalf of the Master Association.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Your name for the record.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Brian Kluke, and along with my co-counsel, Mr. Tim Masterson, I represent two of the appellants in this case. Though I will only be arguing for one, I represent both the Master Association and the Townhomes Association. Mr. Masterson will be arguing on behalf of the Townhomes Association. As mentioned, our division of time is 7 minutes for the Master Association, 2 for Townhomes, 6 for Cottages Association, and Ms. Hansen will be handling the Cottages Association's argument. Ms. Hansen and I have also divided our rebuttal time. We'll both be taking 2.5 minutes. Your Honors, this case involves many issues, but the important thing from the issues that the Master Association raises is that these are all very straightforward issues from a legal sense. We're not contesting any of the facts below. We are simply saying there are legal problems with the conclusions that the district court reached following trial. The first challenge that the Master Association raises is to the jury's award of approximately $186,000. It is the Master Association's position that there is no evidence in the record of two of the necessary elements of that claim that would be needed to sustain that award, evidence of causation and evidence of damages. Now, the award was based on a claim of breach of the duty of good faith. The district court found that the factual basis for that breach of good faith was that the Master Association was allowing the Cottages Association to cast votes on the master board improperly.
Do we know that was the basis for the jury's determination?
Well, the district court had the jury's special verdict form, and it was the district court that made the findings of fact after that. The jury was not presented with the question of the exact
factual. That's what I mean. So the special verdict form doesn't tell us why the jury concluded that there was a breach of that duty. That's a conclusion the district court judge made. Was that the argument that was presented by the condos in support of the claim? I'm just wondering how the district court arrived at that conclusion.
The condos argued that the Cottages was not validly admitted as a member of the master board, and therefore that votes cast after the, so once the Cottages started voting, it effectively created a 2-to-1 situation. And so votes inevitably went
right
against the condo association.
So did the Cottages argue to the jury, and therefore there was a breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing?
Yeah, that was the condo's argument at trial.
So there is support for the district court judge's finding or conclusion that the conduct resulting in the breach was allowing the Cottages to vote when they had not been
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And again, our challenge.
I have a question that's very simplistic, and I need to understand this because the record is so voluminous, and my colleagues maybe have a better handle on this than I do. I don't understand why the Cottages were severed from the townhouse neighborhoods, but it was not severed from the master. Was this just a policy, or was this, does the record bear out how this happened? Was it inadvertent? Is there anything to demonstrate that, how that shook out?
Your Honor, I would point you to Exhibit 33, which is the severance agreement, so there was land set aside for a total of 21 townhomes, but for many reasons, only 10 were ever built because of the housing crash. So there was this vacant land that was sitting within the Grand Central community. And the other important point is that the Master Association has purview over the entire community, and then the associations within that have their own responsibilities. This vacant land was severed in 2013 and used to create a separate association. So what you had was an area of land that was intended to be the townhomes that was severed, and again, this is Exhibit 33, and then the Cottages Association was incorporated in 2013. So the cottages, you know, the cottages had not been built. They did not have a vote on the Master Association until years later after these houses were sold. But that is how the cottages came to have a vote on the Master Association. But again, the condos contest that. They're saying that the Cottages Association was not properly added. So the factual basis is that the cottages were not properly added as a member of the Master Board, and yet they were casting votes, votes that went against the condos. Inevitably, there were a lot of 2-to-1 votes. So
do we assume that the reason the jury based its damage award on the evidence that was offered regarding overpayment of dues?
We assume because that's exactly it. There is no other evidence of damages. So the only evidence of damages in the record, and this is an extremely critical point, is Exhibit 288. That was the exhibit of damages that the condos submitted for their overpayment of dues claim, which the jury decided there was no liability. That was ratified. So you have this dramatic mismatch.
Did the condos argue to the jury or articulate to the jury the manner in which the jury should calculate any damages for the breach of good faith?
No, Your Honor. In fact, at closing argument, plaintiff's counsel said that the breach of good faith or the cottages casting votes was a, quote, non-monetary claim. And we emphasized that in our brief. So there was no argument that Exhibit 288, that the damages in Exhibit 288 were related to the breach of good faith. And hence
yet the jury was asked to determine the amount of damages stemming from any breach of the duty of good faith.
That was on the special verdict form. We came up with a special verdict form, and then closing argument occurred, and there was
argument for monetary damages.
Right. It was, in fact, even described as a non-monetary claim, and importantly, there was no connection to the only item of evidence in the record for damages, which was Exhibit 288.
Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
The other critical point on this claim is that the cottages never cast a vote until 2015. It is not possible. Well, you'll note from Exhibit 288 that it has damages from 2013, 2014. It is simply not possible that conduct that occurred in 2015 caused damages in 2013. It's just not there. So for my time remaining, Your Honors, just wanted to quickly touch on the injunctive relief and declaratory relief. On injunctive relief, there was no controversy. The main basis for both injunctive and declaratory relief is to say that the Master Association had to assess dues on a land area basis. It was assessing dues on a land area
my
basis.
My question about that is if the Master agrees to that, and that's how the Master is now doing it, what's the harm with having the district court at the end of a trial where that was the issue say this is how dues have to be assessed under the current declaration?
The problem is that is an invalid grant of a judgment that goes against my client. So injunctive relief goes against my client. It contributes also to the idea that they are awarded attorney fees because overall success in the case affects attorney fees. So when you have this invalid claim rendered against my client, it very much causes harm in that aspect, one, by being a judgment against my client, and two, for the idea that the condos would be awarded attorney fees based on their success in the case.
As I looked at the case law on injunctive relief, it's clear that there's a distinction between temporary and permanent, and for temporary, you have to show irreparable harm. The standard is pretty high, but then I read several cases that said once there has been a trial regarding the conduct that led to the request for injunctive relief and the judge or jury has decided the issue, then the district court has broad discretion to fashion relief. As I read those cases, it seems to me that the argument that this is invalid injunctive relief is not necessarily consistent with the case law. In other words, I think you might be setting the bar too high for injunctive relief after a trial on the merits.
Your Honor, it's not clear from what the district court decided that this was temporary or permanent, but the district court did say that the Master Association still had the ability to change dues if it wanted. And to me, that makes it more of the nature of a temporary injunction.
A temporary injunction, by definition, isn't it? Is relief that is provided to maintain the status quo until a trial on the merits.
I believe Your Honor's...
So the judge's order is after the trial on the merits, so I don't think we're in the realm of case law governing requests for temporary injunctive relief. This is a post-trial on the merits form of relief.
Your Honor, I would still say it's based on something on which there was no controversy. There was no dispute whatsoever about that. So to the extent it's a judgment against my client without that basis...
Was that litigated at trial? Was argued to the jury, to the judge, or...?
The injunctive relief was purely legal. There weren't arguments to the jury. There was nothing on the special verdict form about injunctive
relief.
But is
it something the judge was asked to decide?
Only after the trial in when we all submitted proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law.
Well, I'm just having a hard time understanding how, if it is an issue the judge was asked to decide and the judge decided it, how there wasn't a controversy, despite the fact that leading up to trial, the master started to assess dues based on land mass.
There was only a controversy because the condos asked for it in their post-trial proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law. Our counterargument was exactly that.
Okay.
There is no controversy here. So, but the district court granted it nonetheless. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. Tim Masterson on behalf of the Grand Central Lofts Townhome Association. I'm speaking here today on the issue of whether the district court abused its discretion when it determined that the condominium association prevailed over the townhomes. The standard is whether the trial court abused its discretion, that meaning the abuse of discretion exists if the trial court based its decision upon erroneous view of the law or contrary to logic and facts in the record. The controlling law is Borchett versus Maloney, and in that case, the Supreme Court of Minnesota held that the prevailing party in any action is the one in whose favor a decision or verdict is rendered and judgment entered. The only decision of record in this case with respect to any claims brought against the Townhomes Association is the court's findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order of judgment of January 7, 2019. And in that, at paragraph 9 in the final order for judgment, addendum page 18, the court said that any and all claims that have been raised in this litigation, but not specifically addressed earlier in the order, are dismissed with prejudice, and such claims are denied. So it is clear in the record that the Townhomes Association prevailed because it got a judgment on the merits on the claims that were brought against the townhomes. It is clear from the law that the townhomes did not need to seek affirmative relief to be a prevailing party. That's the Fernhill Place decision. Plaintiff cannot claim to be a prevailing party if he simply because he prevailed against one other party that has been rejected under staffing specifics. Interim success on motions does not apply because you have to have a decision on the merits. That's the Haugland decision. I see I'm already out of my time.
You can finish your thought. That's fine.
Sure. The one other issue I wanted to address was joint and several liability. There is no explanation by the court how she determined that there would be joint and several liability in this case because, you know, in order to be joint and several, you have to have common liability, and there was no liability finding against the townhomes. We cited federal court cases that are analogous to that. We could not find any state court cases that were directly on point. Other than the fact that joint and several liability is simply, you must have common liability in order for there to be joint and several liability. So that would be the two issues I wanted to address. There was an issue on reasonableness and lodestar of attorney's fees. The statement made by the court was that there was no request to controversy about that issue. It's clearly in the record that All the defendants were contesting the reasonableness of the attorney's fees. We're asking for a lodestar evaluation, which was not done. And the only mention in the record regarding waiver of that was, in fact, Ms. Hansen stating on the record, just to be clear, there is no waiver of reasonableness or lodestar. Thank you.
Any questions?
No.
No. Thank you.
There is a button to lower the podium if you need it.
I happen to be on the shrimpy side of life. May it please the court, my name is Kirsten Hansen and I represent the Cottages. I apologize for my voice, I developed a cold. The key issue I want to raise is that the issue that I believe Judge Werke raised is, what are the Cottages? What we have now in the record appears to be sort of a legal nullity.
Are you asserting, if I'm getting this right, that you don't have any obligation to pay any of the dues to the master?
Yes and no. We have argued it in the alternative. We've said by the master declarations, you're either in or you're out. And the court has created sort of this legal nullity where you're sort of in paying dues, but you're not a neighborhood. And
does the district court's order say that the unit owners in the cottages has to pay dues?
No, and that was in the second motion, or the second round of post-trial motions. One of the things I specifically requested is, Your Honor, we need clarity. What are we? Are we, if you look at the original order,
So as I understand the district court's response to that, it was you didn't litigate or plead the claim that if you're not a valid neighborhood, you shouldn't have to pay dues, therefore I'm not going to rule on that claim.
That was what she said. Unfortunately, that's not correct according to the record. That had always been our argument, is you're either in or you're out.
Okay. Can you direct us to points of the record where, you know, you made clear that that was the claim you were presenting to the district court at trial?
In the pre-post-trial record?
Yeah,
trial. A summary judgment motion would be a good place to start. A lot of this stuff was argued because it's legal. It was argued off the record, unfortunately. This is kind of a troubling record to deal with. Because this was a purely legal issue, is are we in or out?
And right, but as I reviewed the record, I wasn't seeing that as something that was like clearly presented as an issue at trial that needed to be decided. Instead, it seems to have come up after trial and post-trial motions asking the district court to clarify, given the district court's ruling that the cottages were not a valid neighborhood, the court should clarify what the cottages' obligations are under the declaration.
Well, Your Honor, I see where your question is going. I disagree. I think the summary judgment motion makes it clear.
Okay, but the summary judgment motion is a summary judgment motion.
Yeah.
That's denied.
Right.
That's over. Now you go to trial. What did you present at trial, and how did you raise these issues?
There was, through questioning, we were addressing it mostly in the questioning of condos. It was not argued to the court during trial because it was a legal issue, so it was all argued in post-trial motions. It's just the way we had a jury sitting there for a week and they couldn't decide any of the issues that had, you know, questions of law.
One question I have is you represent the Cottages Association.
Correct.
As I look at the declarations, the association is not obligated to pay any dues. The dues are paid by unit owners in the association. Is that a fair reading of the declaration? So I wonder, do you represent those unit owners? I mean, the unit owners are distinct from the association, and you were at trial arguing,
yes,
that the association is or is not a neighborhood, does or does not have voting rights. It seems that the issue of payment of dues relates to an obligation of unit owners and not to the association itself.
The unit owners were never sued in this case.
So thus my question,
yeah,
how do we have a decision regarding what the obligation of the unit owners is in terms of dues payment when they're not a party to this case and that their interests weren't litigated.
I will be perfectly frank, that never crossed my mind, Your Honor. Literally, I think we've always argued this, that the association is the unit owners.
But isn't the association a separate legal entity?
It is. And I honestly never, I will be perfectly frank, we never addressed that ever.
Okay. And then so in the post-trial motions, I mean, did you actually like argue to, did anybody address, here are the declarations, here is what the declaration says about who pays fees, who's obligated to? See, I'm just not feeling like this issue was really fleshed out at trial, and we clearly don't have a firm decision. I understand your frustration. It's like it seems like you can't have it both ways, but I don't know that this court's in a position to say that when the issue wasn't litigated and the party that has the obligation to pay fees wasn't even a party.
As I recall the declarations, the master declarations, I believe it talks about the associations paying the dues. I think they collect it together, but...
Well, they might collect it on behalf of the unit
yeah,
owners, but I think the declaration says that the unit owners pay the dues.
The unit owners ultimately pay the dues because that's where the money comes from. I mean, the association itself has no... assets, essentially. But the dues, the master dues are based on land area, which is collectively determined by the land area of the the cottages.
Well, here I'm looking at 6.6, which says, assessments are levied against neighborhoods or parcels. Owners shall pay the share of the assessment allocated to their parcels directly to the master association. So, I mean, I think that's problematic here. I think there's a big unknown here, simply because this issue wasn't litigated at trial.
It certainly was not. It certainly was not litigated at trial.
So then how would this court, what are we reviewing then? I mean, this court can't decide in the first instance whether or not the individual unit owners in the cottages are obligated to pay dues directly to the Master Association.
Well, currently, how as I read the order, and I'm out of time, may I finish?
Please.
As the orders currently read, the only thing that's ever been addressed is whether or not the cottages themselves are in or out of the master. And if
well,
you're
whether
out
or not
of the master,
they're a neighborhood with voting rights.
It could be a neighborhood, but it doesn't appear that that distinction was made.
Well, in order, the January 7th, 2019 order, the court declares as a matter of law, that the cottages are not a neighborhood
right.
member or voting member. So it looks like we're out. So if you're out, nobody would have to pay anything.
That is an argument.
But the property was originally contemplated within the master.
Well,
that's what Mr. Klug argued, stated, pointed out to me when I'm trying to ferret out who is what and
yeah.
how rights evolve.
And then to follow up on that issue, I mean, do we have a situation where the cottage's property was always a part of the master development and it was severed from the townhomes within that development but remains part of the master development?
This is what we were seeking clarity for. I believe if you read the declarations, if you read through the declarations, and we put this at length in our briefing, you are either a member, a neighborhood, and a member of the association, voting member, or you are not. There is...
I agree with that, but
yeah.
that doesn't address dues-paying obligations of the individual unit owners.
Well, the only thing the court ever said about that was that... the court didn't. That's what we were trying to find out.
So what are we reviewing? You're asking us to make a ruling for the first time on whether individual unit owners of the cottages are obligated to pay dues directly to the master association, given the district court's conclusion of law that their association is not a neighborhood with voting rights.
No, I'm asking the court to review whether or not legally what the court now has created is whether the cottages are either in the master or out of the master.
Isn't that what I just said?
I think when you clarify on the unit owners, I'm asking for something different than what you're focusing on.
What are you asking for?
I am asking for this court to determine if the court, if the district court has created a legal nullity by its order. This we're a sort of in, sort of out. That's the only thing I'm asking about. Well, not
so
the only thing. But
you're not asking about dues then?
Straight up, in or out.
So you are asking about dues?
To the extent that the dues would attach. That was not litigated, so it can't be before the court. We're asking for clarity on what we consider a legal nullity.
Can you tell the court whether there is any information in the record or evidence indicating that the cottages obtained approval from the master, either declarant or board, before recording the declarations by which they intended to become a neighborhood?
Where that would come through would be the testimony from my client about how the whole invitation came in. The declaration would have been recorded before any of my people could testify to it. It was done by the developer, the declarant. And that would be through also the testimony of the townhomes representative and the master and the condos, all saying that they knew what was going on. And that goes to my waiver argument as well, by the way.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Edward Hsu for the respondent condos. The condos brought this case to begin with for three reasons. One, they'd been overpaying dues for about 10 years. Secondly, they tried to work out that problem with the townhomes and cottages without success. And third, they were being treated unfairly and in bad faith by the townhomes and the cottages who were wrongfully commandeering the master. The jury considered all of the claims and defenses and thoughtfully considered the credibility of the witnesses, the weight and fair inferences from the evidence, and the jury instructions and verdict forms were stipulated to. In fact, they were mostly at the request of the appellants to make sure all their defenses were in there. And the district court judge, in reviewing that in post-trial motions, also carefully considered the arguments and thoughtfully evaluated the various positions and reasonably assessed attorney fees for this hard-fought litigation that's over 3.5 years
now. Before we get to attorney's fees, can we talk about the damage award against the master? I'm being told that despite the special verdict question asking the jury to assess the amount of any damages based on breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, in closing argument, the master or the condos argued to the jury that that was a non-monetary claim and there was no specific request for a damage amount or instruction regarding how the jury should calculate monetary damages on the breach of a good faith claim. Is that a misrepresentation of the record?
I believe it is, Your Honor. I was there. That was me doing the argument. So I,
so what did
I respectfully
you argue?
Submit that was not. The truth is, and this is, I think, perhaps if Your Honors are going to focus on anything in this appeal, it's probably the townhomes and master's argument that how do we get $168,000 from the breach of good faith?
I'm wondering that myself. So could you address that?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And with a little bit of background from Your Honor's decision in the Columbia casualty case, I think that's a little bit of helpful guidance. That's the decision we cited in our brief. That was a Rule 12 motion that was granted, and this court...
Could we go back to my question, which was, what did you argue to the jury regarding the amount of damages your client was seeking on the breach of good faith claim and how the jury should arrive at that amount?
The jury was shown Exhibit 288, the chart of overpayments or reimbursement requests totaling $300,000 going back 6 years. And that was for the breach of contract, count three of the complaint. It was for count four, breach of fiduciary duty. It was for count five, breach of statutory duty, and count six, breach of good faith as well. We don't get double recovery on any of those. The jury in the verdict form was given options. Did the master breach the express terms of the contract?
Still not answering my question. What did you argue to the jury about the damage amount for breach of good faith?
I don't know if there is a specific statement in the closing argument,
okay.
Your Honor.
So what you're saying is you didn't distinguish among the counts. You just said to the jury, here's the amount of the overpayments.
Correct.
Use this to calculate damages.
Correct, Your Honor.
So my question becomes this. If the jury made a decision that by conduct, your clients waived the right to recover damages on the breach of contract claim, why doesn't that same waiver apply to the breach of good faith claim if the underlying basis for either claim was inappropriate voting?
The breach of the express provisions of the contract, count three, which the jury found liability on but no damages because of consent, the jury must have looked at the testimony of Mr. Biernot saying that, you know, I went along with that. In 2016, they promised that they would work things out with me, so I agreed to this improper assessment regime. But the jury also credited the fact that the appellants then didn't negotiate in good faith, and they really ought to have assessed the full 6 years, but they picked the four-year.
Why should they have assessed the full 6 years if the damage award is based on inappropriate voting, and there wasn't inappropriate voting for 6 years?
And I want to point that out, Your Honor. It's not just based on inappropriate voting. And the district court's January 2019 order, paragraph 32, says, additionally, the record supports the condo's claim that the Master Association, acting through the townhomes and cottages, took adverse actions to the condo's detriment, such as refusing to negotiate the assessment and payment of dues, et cetera. So throughout the townhomes and master's brief, they say...
That isn't specific. Isn't that inviting speculation and conjecture as far as what the amount is that the jury arrived at? I mean, taking an amount that every year this is the overpayment, that's math, which Mr. Klug is arguing was not correct because they didn't even vote until 2015. But now you're talking about other, I'll call it stuff, but it's not itemized or shown to bear out how that addition came about.
The district court, there's no way around it. They took the 2013 through 2016 years of overpayments to come up with this 186 number. They were a penny or two off, but that has to be the way they did it. There's no speculation there.
But how can that be right? I mean, even as we stand here today, isn't there some agreement that can't be right? They didn't vote until 2015.
Well, that's a different issue, Your Honor. That's suggesting that the damages have to be based on the cottage's improper votes.
Well, the damages have to be based on something, otherwise they're speculative. I mean, you have to tie the harm to the damages. So if the harm is unauthorized voting resulting in over assessment of fees, you're limited to the period in which there was unauthorized voting and inappropriate assessment of fees. And if the harm is refusing to negotiate the manner in which fees were assessed, well, then you have to show, okay, and as a result of that conduct, here was the financial harm. When was the refusal to negotiate? How long was that? I mean, how much fee overpayment was there? There needs to be some connection.
And Your Honor, again, it's not just the improper voting. The record shows that in 2015, when the condos brought this to the townhomes and the cottages. There was foot dragging, and eventually the townhomes and cottages said, we'll rectify this, but you just got to go along with this 2016 budget. And when they refused later, let's put it this way.
Mr. Chu, I think what we're getting at is that we're looking at a jury verdict for damages, and we'd like to harmonize that jury award because we pay, of course, attention to what a jury reaches as far as its conclusions, but you got to give us a roadmap to get there, and I'm not seeing it.
What the jury did was, on the express terms of breach of contract, they said, you know, you consented to it, so we can't award you damages for that. But with the implied breach, we've got a falsification of a title record in 2013, and that's the period they chose. But for, and this is perhaps the way to look at it, but for the improper conduct of the townhome starting in 2013 with that falsification of the record and onwards.
And what's the damages for that?
Well, in 2016,
what's the damage figure for that?
It's the 4 years, 2013 through 2016. It has to be that number. And the basis is, had the townhomes and cottages properly negotiated in good faith as they represented they would, that would have been reimbursed. That would have come back to the condos.
Boy, that seems awful speculative.
Yeah, it does.
And that would have been reimbursed. I mean, the jury already determined that the damages from 2013 to 2016 were a nullity because the condos consented to it.
Under the express terms, Your Honor.
Right. I understand what your argument is there, but express or implied, the condos knew about the misapplication and they consented to it anyway. So what I'm having a hard time distinguishing between the two based upon the record in terms of how the jury could have come up with that figure if they didn't rely on the same damages that they rejected for the express breach.
Well, and that's where the Columbia Casualty case comes in, Your Honor. That case was on a Rule 12 motion. In this case, we've sort of played out where that case was going. That case pointed out that you can alternatively, and you really ought to alternatively plead a breach of express terms of a contract and the implied terms because you might lose on the breach of express terms.
Okay, but how does that doesn't address the issue here, which is, all right, you won on the implied breach. Show us what the amount of damages was as a result of that breach. I agree with you. You can plead in the alternative.
And the damages, Your Honor, for counts 3, 4, 5, and 6 of the complaint are all premised on the same or awfully similar conduct.
It sounds to me like you are trying to argue that there should be a shame on you damage or a punitive damage because of the conduct that took place.
Not at all, Your Honor. Not at all. Had the cottages and townhomes acted in good faith, they would have reimbursed. They would have been required to, with 2 expert opinions, 3 legal opinions, and 2 property managers all saying this is the correct master dues assessment regime.
So did you make this argument that you're making now to the jury so we could say, yep, that was the jury's thinking, it wasn't speculative?
I can't say in closing argument if I articulate
this. Because
same
that's the concern. We need to be able to look at the record and say, okay, we understand how the jury arrived at this figure. It's not speculative. It's not punitive. There's a reasonable basis for it. And one way to do that is to look at what was the argument. How was the jury instructed as to arrive at a damage amount?
Well, and the jury's charge, Your Honor, Judge Logring did a very good job in the instructions and the verdict forms of spelling out the various vehicles in which the lens through which the jury should see things and the questions to be answered.
Could I ask a question about the attorney fees? What's the legal authority for the notion that the attorney fees in this case could be joint and several, assuming there's a basis for attorney fees against the cottages and the townhomes in the first place?
Well, in the district court's discretionary decision, of course we're talking discretion here, the district court viewed the appellants as a side, jointly defending, jointly articulating mostly all the same positions. And so under the Min Kiowa, any party, and that's what this case was all about, was Min Kiowa, attorney fees can be assessed against the responsible party.
So okay, but what if the townhomes and the cottages aren't obligated to pay attorney's fees?
What if they aren't?
Mm-hmm.
By this court's ruling, for example?
Right.
Well,
there's an argument by the cottages that there's no basis for them to have to pay attorney fees, and the townhomes has argued we were the prevailing party. We shouldn't have to pay attorney fees.
And I think, well, if Your Honors were to reverse or remand or something, that might throw into, that might require a remand on the
fees. So your argument in terms of the legal basis for a joint and several attorney fee award is, so long as all 3 defendants are liable, it's within the discretion of the court to order joint and several liability?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so then that would address the argument of the townhomes, which is, we shouldn't be joint and severally liable for anything because joint and several liability requires liability. We have none.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And
you didn't sue the townhomes or the cottages for anything other than this disgorgement claim that was dismissed. So what's the legal basis for any joint and several liability other than the district court's finding that they kind of presented a common defense.
Well, they...
Go ahead.
Well,
you know what I'm getting at.
I mean,
it's kind of hard to have a judgment against someone you haven't sued.
Well, the unusual thing about this, Your Honors, is that the master was the townhomes and cottages. I mean, there's no mistake
there.
They're
three separate entities, and you sued them individually. I mean, your complaint says defendant, master association, on all counts except seven. It says defendants, cottages, and townhomes. So it seems to me like you chose, when you pled the case, to sue the different parties under different theories.
We had to plead it the way we did, Your Honor. It's a bit of a fiction that the master is some separate entity. The master was controlled by the townhomes and the cottages throughout this and defended, and to this day are defended by, even though we ought to have a 50% co-equal right in the master, we had to sue the parties we did in the way we did. And they defended because they are the aggrieved party here. The cottages and the townhomes are the aggrieved party by a judgment against the master. They have to pay more to the master. We pay less. So in terms of
it's a collection issue, maybe. I mean, how are they the aggrieved party if there was no basis for liability against them? I mean, maybe the master's on the hook here, and there's no way to collect it because the only source of income the master has is from parties that haven't been sued. I mean, I'm having a hard time making that jump.
Well, they clearly thought they had the standing to defend the master because they were going to be affected by this. So it's a little unusual, Your Honor. I mean, there was a suggestion at some point in the case that this ought to have been a derivative case, that there should have been a demand made in that sense, but that argument really never went anywhere. We had to sue these three parties, and the disgorgement claim was dismissed because it would have been redundant of the other relief we sought. It would have been... We ultimately just said, we overpaid and you got to pay us back. We don't really care who. And so once the master was ordered to pay back, the funds would come from the townhomes and the cottages. Your Honor, if I may briefly address some of the points on...
You didn't dismiss the disgorgement claims actively. The district court dismissed them.
Well, at the bench meeting before the jury instructions were prepared, we agreed not to put them on the verdict form. Breach of fiduciary duty was also agreed not to be put on the jury form. It was 21 questions. That was long enough, I think.
Go ahead.
If the court has any questions, if I could just very briefly address a couple points, I promise I'll be done quickly. The cottages say that, just look at the record, and you'll see how they've argued that they're this separate. They seceded from the union. They're an independent. They declared independence. That's not true. When you look at their summary judgment motion, they argued statute of limitations. They said you can't challenge our right to be a member of the master board. Throughout this litigation, they said we are a member of the master board. We properly became one, and you're too late. It's only when the jury rendered its verdict that they tried to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat with this new, admittedly clever argument. But the district court properly said that you're bringing a bunch of new issues in here. I can't deal with this. And you ought to have pleaded in the alternative 2.5 years ago.
What seems odd about that argument, not yours, but is that this isn't your typical single family home situation. My single family home, I own the land I'm sitting on. There's nothing in the record that I could find that say these cottages own the land. Somebody owns this land that they're part of this association with, which is what alleged. Am I right about that?
I think so, Your Honor.
That's what makes this case so odd, you know, in terms of that. Whether if they're independent, then who owns the land they're sitting on?
Right. And, Your Honor, they have a hard time trying to alienate it in any way because there's a bunch of documents recorded in the recorder's office encumbering all of our land. But we submit that the jury adequately sorted out all these complex issues and the district court thoughtfully considered the parties' arguments as well.
Did the jury or the district court sort out what the cottage's obligations are to the master, given that it's not a valid neighborhood?
That was not presented, Your Honor. The cottage's position throughout was that you waived it. And Mr. Wilson, Ms. Hansen mentioned her own client's testimony. He said, I heard from Ms. Armold that we were properly made a neighborhood and a voting member. They took that position throughout trial.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Rebuttal, and you'll have adequate time to respond to the points that have been made. Are we splitting the time?
Yes.
Okay.
Your Honors, again, Kirsten Hansen. I think we all understand how complex this is. Judge Flory, I did want to address. It is my understanding that the people who own the cottages actually own title to the land. It's a question of whether or not there's an encumbrance on it. So
who owns the land?
The people who live on it.
There's nothing in the record on that.
No, it'd be...
It was really confusing, quite frankly, what the legal relationships were.
It is. This is the problem, is the declarations and the titles and everything all contradict each other. Ultimately, that's the problem with this entire mess, is that everything...
That's a good reason for the parties to have tried to sort out the mess instead of bringing a part of the mess to the court for litigation.
I recognize that settlement discussions are not anything. We tried. We tried. I don't think... We tried. A lot. Including right before this matter was submitted to the jury. I think it's...
Well, it's unfortunate because it sounds like there are still unanswered questions. There's
exactly.
Not clarity, despite years of litigation, a long trial, and a lot of attorney fees.
Exactly.
So I don't know who the winner is here.
Just an observation. I do not disagree with you, even in the slightest. I think you are absolutely right. I did want to address, though, the attorney's fees issue, just to direct the court back to where we were arguing, is that you can award attorney's fees under statute or contract. Neither one of them apply to us, and we would ask that be dismissed. That's the only financial judgment against us. So, and I argued it more in my briefs, but I think we also... There's just no way to do the joint and several, as far as I can tell, on attorney's fees. So, and you've heard a lot from me today. So,
and we're willing to give you a little more time because these are important issues. If there are anything else you would like to address, take your time.
Excuse me. I beg your pardon.
No, you're fine. As long as you don't have coronavirus.
That's quarantiner.
Sorry.
No, I'm sorry. All right, so just so I'm understanding what you're saying on behalf of the cottages, you're saying the district court was incorrect in authorizing attorney's fees against your client because there's no authority by statute or by contract, and that it's only the master that can seek attorney's fees for noncompliance.
Correct, Your Honor. And again, I would go back to actually how Judge Flory pointed it out. If you go back to the original complaint and what was pled out. And that was going to be my next point. So that was what I wanted to say on attorney's fees. And the rest I will rest on the briefs
right.
for.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The court is exactly right on how it is viewing the jury award as opposed to what was argued, and so I wanted to provide some citations to the record where you can verify that was the case. The closing argument of plaintiff's counsel is in document 203, trial transcript volume 4. It's page 817 to page 818, and you can look at that closing argument. Never once is the words breach of good faith ever even mentioned. He specifically describes the cottages voting on the master board as a non-monetary claim. There is no request for any amount of damages for the claim, and specifically not in the amount of $186,000. That was just something that the jury came up with. Judge Flory is exactly right on how the claim was pled out. The Master Association is a separate legal entity. The Townhomes Association is a separate legal entity, as is the cottages. The idea that, well, the sub-associations vote on the master board, therefore they're sort of all together, it simply isn't borne out by the legal relationships of these parties. Finally, I also wanted to address and just make clear, the claim for breach of good faith was not pleaded in the alternative to the overassessment of dues claim. These are for separate conduct, separate areas of the master declaration. So these are not alternative claims. We explained that more fully in our briefing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to the parties. We recognize that these are complex issues and a complex record, and we appreciate your briefing and your arguments. The case is submitted. You'll have our decision within the 90 days required by statute.
Thank you.
No, we can take care of that. Thank you.